The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We thank you for listening to the show today. In Washington, the annual shutdown crisis appears to have been averted for now, so long as the House and Senate give their final approval to a temporary spending measure by 11:59 p.m. tonight when the fiscal year ends. Government agencies will keep running, but only through December 11th. Now, avoiding a shutdown today, in a way, was easy. John Boehner is on the way out as Speaker, and that means conservatives can't hurt him for passing this bill. But avoiding a shutdown or worse could be much harder in January or in December when there's not Boehner to kick around anymore. Congress has huge issues like tens of billions of dollars at stake in a budget deal that needs to happen. Also missing in today's shutdown averting move, any mention of defunding Planned Parenthood, something many conservative Republicans are still demanding, and those demands aren't going away. On Tuesday, Planned Parenthood's president, Cecile Richards, testified before the House Oversight Committee. She said videos released by anti-abortion activists were edited to mislead the public.
The outrageous accusations leveled against Planned Parenthood based on heavily doctored videos are offensive and categorically untrue.
We're going to have more on the clash between Republicans and Planned Parenthood coming up. But first, more on what's ahead for Congress between today's deadline and the looming December deadline. I'm joined by Kelsey Snell. She's with The Washington Post. She's my colleague on Capitol Hill. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. So a shutdown avoided today and everybody's kind of gets a half a sigh of relief, but there's much more to come.
Yeah, we are expecting them to pass the spending bill pretty quickly in the Senate in the morning and then move things along in the House. They have hours to act, but that should be plenty of time. The idea now is that they'll start some sort of budget negotiations. And yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he'd like to get started writing, you know, spending top line targets that would take you through maybe through 2017 if they're lucky.
So McConnell really wants a 2-year budget deal here. And behind all this is a desire on the part of Mitch McConnell and in a way, John Boehner, too, to kind of clear the decks. A 2-year budget deal would mean no more shutdown fights. We can have a presidential run, you know, without the public thinking Republicans are shutting things down again.
Right. That's absolutely the motivation. They don't want to be having another spending fight of any kind before the election. They also don't want to be talking about raising any more spending. That's undoubtedly what they will do at this point if they're able to reach a deal, is lift the spending caps that were put in place as a part of the Budget Control Act or the sequester. And that doesn't play very well for Republicans out campaigning on being deficit hawks.
Right. Well, McConnell and Boehner have to get together with President Obama. They need Nancy Pelosi in the room because you may need Democratic votes on board. You need Harry Reid in there. You know, Kelsey, this is all a big problem maybe for those very same conservatives who just managed to oust John Boehner. Why is John Boehner going to the Oval Office to negotiate tens of billions of dollars with Barack Obama when they just got rid of him? They're not going to go for that.
Well, actually, his decision to leave made it a lot easier for him to negotiate. They don't have anything, the conservatives don't have anything to hold over Boehner's head any longer. So he has 30 days to cement a deal if he's going to get one. And whether or not he gets one is still definitely up in the air. The idea is that it would be easier if nobody can threaten his job any longer for him to cut a deal, to put, you know, all the wheels in motion so that whoever takes over kind of has to finish the work he began.
Whoever takes over is likely, although not definitely, to be Kevin McCarthy of California, the majority leader. We've talked about his run for speaker. Kevin McCarthy has some decisions to make here. He's seeing John Boehner, the lame duck speaker, maybe trying to cut a massive budget deal with Democrats. McCarthy might have to oppose it.
He might, and that's the big question that a lot of Democrats have. The joke was after Boehner resigned that this was not Democrats' problem for the exact duration of the moment they were saying it wasn't their problem. We definitely expect that, you know, conservatives are going to want a price for what they see as a victory getting Boehner to resign, and they want the next leadership to really respect conservative principles as they see them, and that likely will include trying to push for spending cuts and definitely for continued votes on Planned Parenthood and votes to defund Obamacare. There's a long list of things they feel like they haven't had a chance to really make a point on.
Another thing that they might want, you know, we mentioned Kevin McCarthy, and I got to let you go, Kelsey Snell, but there are a lot of conservatives who don't think he's conservative enough. There was a little boomlet yesterday that they're pushing forward Trey Gowdy of South Carolina. They want him to run for speaker.
They do. And he says that he is not running, but he is definitely a voice of the conservative pact in the conservative section of the House. And the draft Trey Gowdy movement is not going anywhere anytime soon.
The draft Trey Gowdy movement getting in the way of Kevin McCarthy for speaker, all the backdrop of a spending and debt limit fight that is to come. Kelsey Snell of The Washington Post, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In Congress, Republicans in the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee questioned Planned Parenthood President Cecile Richards on her organization's use of taxpayer funding yesterday, and on a series of sting videos that depicted Planned Parenthood personnel speaking about donations of fetal tissue in, at times, crass ways. There were a lot of heated exchanges in this five-hour hearing, including this.
And we don't think eating dinner salads and drinking wine while you're discussing infanticide, we have a problem with that, too. So I'm sure you can understand why we would be as viscerally opposed to what we saw on some of the tapes. Would you not?
I feel like everything I've answered you see in a different way. So I respect your opinions and...
Cecile Richards, president of Planned Parenthood there. Now, you just heard from the very same Trey Gowdy of South Carolina that I just talked about with Kelsey Snell, a member who some conservatives want to draft to run for speaker. Irene Carmone is a national reporter for MSNBC. She's author of the forthcoming book, Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that comes out in late October. She joins me in the studio. Irene, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard from Trey Gowdy there, one of the many stars of this hearing. What was his role yesterday? He's got a high-profile role that's increasing.
Well, there wasn't a single Republican that didn't react with abject fury having Cecile Richards before them. This is really the first time that she's been made to face the committee. There have been other committee hearings of the four in the House of Representatives that are investigating Planned Parenthood in the wake of these videos. But this is the first time that there was an opportunity to face off Planned Parenthood's president. And I found Trey Gowdy's comments really interesting because it's referring to the first video that was released of the many secretly recorded videos that have been released by the anti-abortion group Center for Medical Progress. But it's not about fetal tissue donation. It's not about abortion. It's about eating salad and discussing infanticide. And I think when Cecile Richards objected to that characterization, she does not consider abortion infanticide. They're discussing abortion procedures. But just the optics of this Planned Parenthood doctor being caught on tape eating salad, I think was really being played up for maximum. You're not one of us. You guys are elitists. You sit in California drinking wine and eating salad. Now, Cecile Richards has apologized for that particular video, what she said was a not compassionate tone of that staff member. But at that point, it really sort of crystallized that they were portraying Planned Parenthood as a sort of un-American elitist force.
And it was that apology itself that wound up the topic of a long, heated exchange between conservative leader Jim Jordan and Cecile Richards. Listen.
Well,
It is as simple and as basic as it gets. You don't apologize for things that are inaccurate. You apologize for things that are accurate. And you said there were statements in that first video that I want to apologize for. I'm asking you to tell this committee chairman, this committee, and the American people, what were those statements?
Well, I think I've already made my explanation.
Irene Carmone, you know, I wonder after all the shouting that took place yesterday, did we learn anything? Did we learn anything new about Planned Parenthood or about where members of Congress stand on abortion for that matter?
Well, many folks who may not have been aware of Cecile Richards' salary, which is in the mid-six figures, may have learned that. But I think ultimately, you know, there is a profound disagreement about abortion. There wasn't so much conversation about fetal tissue donation, which is legal under specific regulations in a bipartisan law that passed in 1993. What we did learn is that many people are outraged at abortion. And we learned that Democrats are standing by Planned Parenthood. There was a sort of initial pause when the first videos were released. I think people were trying to get information. The optics of talking about late abortion in a casual, you said crass way, that's the video with salad, the first video of the 10, I believe, that were released. But now after months of this story being all over the place, after every single Republican candidate talking about it, the dust has settled a little bit. You know, we had an NBC Wall Street Journal poll that was released this week that showed that Planned Parenthood is still more popular than any political party, any political figure, more popular than Barack Obama, the Republican Party, Donald Trump. This is after months of this kind of care. Months of this kind of, you would call it bad publicity at the very least.
So is it safe to say then, despite the election year highlight reel on the divisive issue of abortion, that really the country still knows where it stands on abortion, pro or con, after yesterday's 5 hours?
Well, something that's really important to say is that the federal funding that was being discussed doesn't go to abortion. So the country remains divided on abortion. It's more or less an even split, depending on how you ask the question. Many people want say that they support Roe v. Wade, but call themselves pro-life. It's a complicated question. But the Planned Parenthood funding and Planned Parenthood itself is popular because that funding goes to very consensus care, such as contraception and cancer screenings.
And Planned Parenthood, of course, not being defunded in today's spending bill that avoids a government shutdown. Erin Carmon, national reporter for MSNBC, author of Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jimmy Carter turns 91 tomorrow, Thursday, October 1st. Earlier this year, America's 39th president announced he had been diagnosed with melanoma that had spread to his brain. But with characteristic good humor, Carter told reporters how much he was looking forward to a new adventure. His 92nd year will be one where Jimmy Carter measures time a little differently. And the takeaway is doing the same. We're imagining a world where America woke up to a second Carter term on November 4th, 1980. Now, just suppose for a second that Ronald Reagan's Let's Make America Great Again had not struck a national chord. Would it have been a more perfect union then? Well, this week we saw Shell pull out of the Alaskan Arctic. It was a move cheered by environmentalists. It's interesting, maybe, to imagine where we'd be today as a nation on climate change and the environment if Carter had 4 more years. Historian Douglas Brinkley says President Carter was indeed a true environmentalist.
He really believed that the momentum was with him. Earth Day was created in 1970 in the Environmental Protection Agency, and we have this spat of environmental laws. The whole country seemed to be behind endangered species and clean air and water, clean rivers. And Carter continued that, and he saved enormous amount of public lands as national monuments and national parks. Only Theodore Roosevelt and FDR is equal to that. And as his push to do alternative energy, I think, would have defined a lot of his second term. And so we may have been at a different place right now in that regard. Instead, Reagan put in James Watt, the most retrograde Interior Secretary in American history, and started trying to just open up the public lands, mine, 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 and drill, drill, drill.
From the Middle East, foreign policy, human rights, to national security and the U.S. economy, on his birthday this year, it's Carter reimagined.
Would President Carter have supported the kind of tax cuts President Reagan did? I doubt it, but I think he quite possibly would have moved some distance in that direction.
The remarkable thing about Jimmy Carter is he had no Supreme Court vacancies in the 4 years that he served in the White House, and that's pretty unusual.
It's a special hour imagining a second Carter term, hosted by John Hockenberry tomorrow. That's on The Takeaway. Over the weekend, New Jersey high school star quarterback Evan Murray collapsed on the sidelines and later died. An autopsy revealed on Monday that the cause was a ruptured spleen after a hit on the field. It was a rare incident in a sport that's found itself under a microscope in recent years, as evidence mounts against the safety of the sport, particularly at the professional level, and as science has emerged surrounding the consequences of brain injuries, concussions, including chronic traumatic encephalopathy, better known as CTE. But away from the pros, more than a million young athletes play football at the high school level. Deaths are, of course, rare. Just 5 were recorded among high school students last year. But some schools are less willing to take even that risk. I'm joined by Nelson Mitten. He's president of the Maplewood Richmond Heights School Board, just outside of St. Louis. And in June, that school board decided to end its football program. Nelson, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Ending a football program at an American high school, let's be honest, is a really big step. Why did you close it down?
Yes, it is. It was actually a very big step for our district. For our board, and I think as any other school board, the health and safety of our students is paramount. Last year, we only fielded a team of approximately 20 students. During the course of the season, a number of fairly significant injuries occurred, including an ACL tear, a significant concussion, a broken ankle, and a number of other minor injuries. Such injuries were so paramount through the team that we ultimately even had to cancel a game mid-season. So at the end of the season, the board decided to do an assessment of the program to make sure that we were able to field a team that was not only competitive, but also a team that was going to be able to be safe in our students' play. After doing a poll of the students, we found that we really only had interest of about 12 to 15 students. So to some degree, the decision became easy. But by the same token, we were trying to assess whether we could field a team that would be competitive with schools and that we could have a team that was large enough to basically not be injured on the field.
So as you were going through this assessment, you said you had a number of acute injuries, knees and ankles. What was more of a concern, those acute injuries of kids winding up on crutches or the other injuries that you talked about, which can be much more chronic, the head injuries, the concussions, and what that can sort of do down the line to a person?
Well, the whole issue about head injuries definitely played a backdrop in this. The issue about concussions was not a paramount concern. It was not one at the front. It was more just the overall issue of injuries across the board and whether we were putting kids on the field that were basically going to be susceptible to injury because of the lack of numbers and their size.
Well, is the area of the Maplewood-Richmond Heights School District, you know, are you guys a soccer town? Is it the case that maybe nobody's going to miss football all that much because all the best athletes want to play soccer?
I don't know about that. I mean, we are still investigating whether we can renew the program. And we do think that may be one of the reasons why there has been a decline in interest in football is we now have a significant increase in interest in soccer and in students, both male and female, coming out for soccer teams.
So that's really interesting, Nelson Mitten, because if you were approaching the story, you might think, well, this town was concerned about injuries. They canceled football for this year, but this is a town that's going to do an assessment in football will come back. You're describing a place where football's been canceled and maybe people are going to be fine with that.
Yes, as I indicated, we just did not have the outcry that we expected. Maplewood-Richmond Heights has a fine football tradition. I've been to a number of alumni gatherings where I've spoken to alums from the 60s and 70s, and they talked glowingly of their past records on the football field. And just 5 years ago, our football team was in the state championship for its class. So we do have a fine football tradition. But by the same token, we do need to cater to the needs and desires of our students now. And if there's not that strong of an interest, we will basically not renew the program and just go with soccer and maybe providing other sports and outlets.
You know, President Mitten, anytime there's a safety assessment like this, like the one that you've done, it's useful to look at the real world. And it makes sense in a lot of ways that you saw these injuries and you saw the health of your students and you decided to cancel football. Lots of your students drive to school every morning. Lots of them drive on the weekends. And as we both know, that's way more dangerous to their health than playing football. Talk a little bit about that comparison. I mean, certainly you're not going to ban students from driving to school. So how do you weigh that?
I'm not really sure. I mean, I guess you can weigh it in a fashion that driving is not something that we can necessarily control. And furthermore, driving is something, a daily activity that people have to engage in. Football is a sport. It is an extracurricular activity. And if you create a forum for students, especially a forum where it's more likely than not that students may become injured, I think you have a duty as a public official to assess that and make a determination and make the decision on that health and safety concerns that are within your control.
The school district of Maplewood-Richmond Heights, just outside of St. Louis, has canceled football after an assessment of the safety of students and also the interest of the town. Nelson Mitten is the president of that school board. Mr. Mitten, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maplewood Richmond High School outside of St. Louis is one of just a very small number of schools that have made the decision to abandon football. There are more than 14,000 high schools nationally that have programs. But many of you share a similar uncertainty over the role of sports in your lives and the lives of kids across the country.
My name is Ryan Bossy. I graduated high school in 2007 from Fergus Falls, Minnesota, and I quit football just before what would have been my junior season in 2005.
Like many young players, Ryan, who's now 26, says he grew up around the sport.
I had been a football fan since I was really just a kid. My dad grew up watching college football, professional football, and had me alongside with him. My brother played high school football. My dad played high school football. So really it was just a kind of, you know, an exciting time in your life because it was your turn. It was your chance to play. And really, I just loved it. I just fell in love with the sport, all the passion that people have for it, and all of the excitement that's generated around it.
But after the excitement wore off, Ryan decided it wasn't something he wanted to continue doing anymore.
I just hated playing with all of that violence and pain. All of my memories that I have now of football are when I've actually gotten hurt or when somebody else got hurt. And that was just something that I didn't really particularly enjoy and wasn't motivated to continue in. But still, there's a certain aspect of kind of feeling defeated, and also that whole, you know, it was a pretty conservative area where I grew up, so just not being man enough or, you know, that masculinity aspect was really not something that was overtly pushed on me, but, you know, you can't help but feel it in that environment.
My name is Zach Walker, and I'm a 14-year-old freshman at Westboro High School in Westboro, Massachusetts.
14-year-old Zach says he would be devastated if his school ever canceled its football program. It's a sport, he says, that's instilled confidence and motivation in him from a young age, despite the risks.
I started playing football in fifth grade. I love the game and cannot imagine not being able to play. I left a youth game once by ambulance after a helmet-to-helmet hit. It was very scary, but the coaches and trainers did not want to take any unnecessary chances with my safety. I was cleared to play, and while I know it was hard for my parents to see me back out on the field, I never considered giving up the game.
And Zach's mom, Lee, agrees. She's backing him up.
He plays a lot of football. Every week, practice and games, it's a tremendous amount of time and effort. Do I worry? Absolutely. But this is his passion. The life lessons and skills he learns from being on a football team far exceed a game of X's and O's. And I believe the rewards of playing on any team sport outweighs the risks, which are inherent in nearly every sport.
Lee sees the risks, accepts them, and makes the case that it's a lot less dangerous than the other things that kids do, like driving.
Zach isn't quite old enough yet to drive. I still have that to look forward to. Driving is one of the most dangerous things a young person can do, yet it is the rare parent who says, no, my kid is not going to drive.
This is Eddie Canales. I'm the founder of Gridiron Heroes Spinal Cord Injury Foundation. Gridiron Heroes was started after my son suffered a spinal cord injury playing high school football.
Eddie has a son, Chris, who in 2001 had three offers to play college football. He made a touchdown-saving tackle that paralyzed him from the shoulders down in 2001. But Eddie says his son doesn't blame the game, and he doesn't either.
We are always asked why we still support the game of football. Have to understand that our young men still love the game of football. They don't blame the game for their injuries. You always hear that it's more than just the X's and O's. That's never more prevalent than when you're having to visit a young man that has suffered a spinal cord injury and is fighting for his life. And if they have a love for the game, let them play. The other thing is that we can't put our kids in a bubble. We have had calls not only from football, but we've had a pole vaulter, a baseball player, a hockey player, lacrosse player, cheerleaders, wrestler, just about every sport that you can think of that we may have had a call where someone has suffered a spinal injury. But there are some good things that come out of playing the game of football and participating in athletics in general.
That's Eddie Canales, a dad from Texas. We got some powerful stories from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always comment at thetakeaway.org. The Y2K of medicine, that's how some doctors are describing the rollout of a whole new payment system set to begin tomorrow on October 1st. Now, today, when you go to the doctor's office sends a claim to your insurance company to get paid. And there's a big system of codes that correspond to certain procedures or illnesses like broken wrist or strep throat culture. They write down a number, the insurance company pays or doesn't in some cases. But tomorrow, Doctors and hospitals all across the country are getting a new set of codes and a whole lot of new options. The old system has just 14,000 codes. The new one, 70,000. And all the new codes, they're really specific. There's even one for getting sucked into a jet engine. So apart from airport workers, I guess, how does this affect doctors and insurers and patients? Joining us is Dr. Michael Marks. He's an orthopedic surgeon and healthcare consultant. Dr. Marks, welcome.
Hi there, Todd.
The Y2K of doctors' offices, is that fair?
Well, actually, I don't think that actually goes far enough. Y2K turned out to be not much of anything. I think this is really actually going to be something. And the data and statistics actually is probably more than 91,000 diagnostic codes that are going to have to be utilized starting tomorrow, October 1st.
Okay, fair enough. But big doctors' offices do have professionals who speak the language of these codes. It's their job to get the codes in the forms, to get the doctor's office paid. So you already have those people in a lot of offices. Can't they do this?
Well, the actual answer to that is maybe. And obviously, we're going to find out going forward. But as you mentioned, this is a lot about increased specificity, which is how you wind up increasing the number of codes. So in the world of orthopedics, and the orthopedic surgeon's probably been hit the hardest by all this, 65% of those more than 91,000 codes are going to affect them. And that's because for the first time, we're talking about laterality. Was it the right wrist or the left wrist that was broken? So a coder can only code if the doctor or other healthcare provider is putting the specificity in there to be able to them to code it.
Now, what's the virtue of making this language so much more specific? I understand that it's less convenient. I understand there's a lot more words to know if you want to call it a language, but what's the advantage here?
Well, the whole coding system is actually developed by epidemiologists, and they want to know data, statistics for societal resources going forward. So this generation of healthcare providers probably will not see much upside to this increased specificity. Maybe 15, 20, 25 years from now, they'll find out that, wow, look at that. It seems that 90% of the carpal tunnels are on the right than on the left. Why is that happening?
I have a long history myself of covering medicine and covering doctors, and it seems like almost every step of the way, doctors resist change. Doctors resisted, in a lot of cases, electronic medical records. They certainly resisted, in a lot of cases, the changes in Obamacare. They've resisted Medicare changes. This seems like another case of improvement in record keeping or practice that doctors just don't like because they want to be left alone.
Well, I don't think it's as much that, but the last industrialized country, and I don't want you to fall off your chair when I tell you this, but the last industrialized country to move to ICD-10 was Canada. And that was back in 2000. We're now going live with it. We've kicked the can down the road a couple of times. But in this country, coding is done by individual hospitals. It's done by individual providers. In Canada, ICD-10 is only used on the inpatient side, as I understand it, and all the coders are government employees. So I'm not saying that the system is wrong, but it becomes another unfunded mandate. And so because it's not necessarily set up the correct way, I've been going to my Facebook account and communicating with people and lecturing all over the country to say, look, let your patients know that there may be some glitches in all of this where claims may get denied. We don't 100% know if all the insurers are going to be up to speed, all the EMRs are up to speed. So I think it's the fear of Y2K, but just that much times larger.
That's Dr. Michael Marks, orthopedic surgeon and healthcare consultant. Dr. Marks, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Todd.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. From record-breaking cyclist Lance Armstrong to Olympic champion track and fielder Marion Jones to baseball superstar Alex Rodriguez, doping has been a source of both great historic performances and great historic scandals. The World Anti-Doping Agency and the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency have both invested millions of dollars and man-hours in an effort to cut down on the use of performance-enhancing drugs. But the new documentary, Doped, The Dirty Side of Sports, argues that these efforts have both been intrusive to athletes who don't cheat and ineffective at reducing doping. Andrew Moscato is the director of Dope. It premieres tonight on Epics, and he joins me now in the studio. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Andrew, I got to start right off the top. The main conclusion of your film is that all of the anti-doping, all of the steroid testing, all of the EPO testing that we've heard about in sports has led to some big high-profile busts, but has basically not reduced the level of cheating in sports. That's a huge claim.
Yeah, and it's one that's backed up based on the data of the World Anti-Doping Agency, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, and even professional sports leagues like Major League Baseball. What you're seeing across the board is that less than 1% of tests are leading to some sort of sanction. So when you have the anecdotal evidence, which would seem to suggest 20, 30, or even 40% of athletes in sport are doping, less than 1% is a very poor success rate.
So why such a poor success rate? You make the point in the film that athletes who are clean, and I mean, you can't tell who's clean and who's not unless you test, so you have to be strict. But there's a system now that follows people around at every stage of their lives but isn't catching the guilty parties.
Right. And surprisingly, even testing can't prove who's clean or who's dirty. I mean, Lance Armstrong famously would declare that he never failed the drug test. That was a similar claim that Marion Jones often had. And later, of course, those athletes were proven to have doped. So I think that's the main problem here, is that we've developed a system over the last decade and a half which doesn't really do a good job of catching the cheaters, and there's really no proof that it deters athletes from cheating.
So a lot of the history of the World Anti-Doping Agency and this worldwide testing goes back to the Olympics in 1988. Canadian sprinter Ben Johnson, I'm sorry to say I remember him, who had a huge downfall after winning the gold medal and then testing positive. That led to, you say in the film, this new regime. Listen to Dick Pound. He's president of the World Anti-Doping Agency. He's also a Canadian Olympic official.
I thought, well, at least this will perhaps discourage people, but it'll certainly make it clear that the IOC at the Olympic Games is not going to cover up any doping test at all. And I was half right. The IOC didn't cover it up, but the doping went on.
Now, there's Dick Pound. He's in charge of WADA, who says this new worldwide regime of testing basically didn't stop doping.
Right. Well, actually, Dick Pound is talking still about the IOC testing programs, and that was in 1988. The World Anti-Doping Agency, which he spearheaded the creation of, didn't come around until 1999, and that was an outgrowth of this big scandal in the Tour de France called the Festina scandal, where the Festina riding team was caught with drugs in the trunk of their car. So the World Anti-Doping Agency was established in 1999, around the turn of the century. Major League Baseball, the NFL followed suit. They created their own testing policies. But what's amazing and what this film looks at is how ineffective these programs have been, I think, despite public confidence that because there's drug testing in sports, somehow sport is cleaner.
Now, are you saying then that Major League Baseball, that the NFL, despite the appearance of being cleaner, despite high-profile busts, despite their own PR that they've cleaned up their sports, are still riddled with HGH and steroid users?
Performance-enhancing drug use goes beyond just testosterone and HGH, but I think the answer has to be yes. I mean, look at Alex Rodriguez as a perfect example. Here's somebody who is using testosterone for the past decade. He gets caught from an investigation, not from drug testing. The fact that they have tests that athletes who are using these substances know how to beat. Also, you have what's called a therapeutic use exemption in sports. So baseball, take that for example. Adderall is a drug that I think a third of the league has a therapeutic use exemption for. Basically, they have a doctor's note to use this drug. The highest number of sanctions for performance-enhancing drug use in baseball is for Adderall. So it's not cheating if you have the doctor's note, but it is cheating if you don't. So I think that's the gray area that most people don't understand about drug use in sports.
I love the statistic in your film. It hit me pretty hard that WADA's entire budget, the budget of the World Anti-Doping Agency, is $27 million, which is almost exactly A-Rod's annual salary.
It's amazing because, again, this is the World Anti-Doping Agency. So as a fan, before going into this project, a casual sports fan, I figured that the World Anti-Doping Agency had the problem of doping in sport pretty much under control. And when they have a budget that small, I think what it seems to suggest is that countries in the Olympic movement who are stakeholders kind of want to fund WADA, but they don't want to fund them enough. So they can say, hey, look, we care about doping. You can't, we're giving money to the World Anti-Doping Agency, so don't accuse us of not doing the best we can. But I don't think they're giving them enough where they can actually do their job. And I think an example of that is that WADA, surprisingly, doesn't have a lot of control over these national anti-doping agencies, which are supposed to enforce the World Anti-Doping Code or the World Anti-Doping Rules. Athletes in Russia this past year claiming that there's Soviet-style, you know, state-sanctioned doping going on. In our film, we talk about how Jamaica wasn't drug testing their athletes before the 2012 London Olympics. And here in the U.S., you have the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, supposedly the gold standard of all these national anti-doping agencies, coming under a lot of scrutiny for their practices in boxing, which is kind of outside of the Olympic purview, and this kind of work for hire that they're doing on the side. So in that case, they seem to be motivated more by profit than their mission of quote-unquote clean sport.
Which is an inherent conflict of interest. That's the point that you make.
Right. So in boxing, they're basically taking various sums of money to do testing. Floyd Mayweather is probably their most notable client. And he likes to claim that he's doing Olympic-style testing, quote-unquote. But Olympic-style testing involves unannounced drug testing 24/7, 365. Olympic athletes actually have to report their whereabouts, where they're going to be of all hours a day. If you change from that schedule, you have to update your doping control officer. Floyd Mayweather only gets tested in the months leading up to his fight and usually signing that drug testing contract 3 months before. So he's not getting year-round testing. Recently, it was discovered that he was given a therapeutic use exemption retroactively for a method that's banned by WADA. He had a IV with a saline solution, which is kind of a big no-no in all other realms of sport, but somehow it was kind of given a pass in boxing.
One of the key points that you make here in this film is that USADA, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, makes these high-profile busts and then below the surface isn't doing its job.
Right. And again, that's just based on the data. It's usually the low-hanging fruit, the athletes who are either inadvertently doping by way of a tainted dietary supplement or athletes who aren't even high-level athletes at all. You see amateur athletes who will somehow get subject to USADA testing at an event. Lance Armstrong and guys like him are a very small percentage of athletes being caught by this anti-doping system.
Andrew Moscato is director of the documentary Doped, The Dirty Side of Sports. It premieres tonight on Epics. Andrew Moscato, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Todd.
And finally, here's something to take with you today. Take out your wallet for a second. Is there a chip in your credit card? Starting tomorrow, many retailers will only accept credit cards with a small computer chip known as an EMV chip embedded. These chips can't be copied and counterfeited in the way that a magnetic strip can. And maybe this is the most important point. The use of that chip shifts liability for credit card fraud away from the Amexes and Visas and MasterCards of the world and onto the retailers, right? Experts don't expect these new chips to end all credit card fraud. But now if you try, hey, I'll bet you bite a chip. Sorry for that. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always send your tweets our way at The Takeaway. You can take us with you. Subscribe to The Takeaway podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service where you get your podcast fix. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.